Today is December 2nd. We are interviewing Mr. Pete Tijerina for the U.S. Latino and Latina World War II Oral History Project. My name is Maggie Rivas Rodriguez. I will be joined later by Mauro Robbins. We're sitting in Mr. Tijerina's office in San Antonio, Texas. Mr. Tijerina, thank you very much for agreeing to be interviewed today. We're going to start off by talking a little bit about MALDEF.
Okay.
Mauro is going to talk about your early years and bring you up through going to law school. And what I'm very interested in is finding out, I guess I'd like to start with that case in Jordanton of Mrs. Munoz.
Ms. Munoz?
Yeah, tell us about that.
I guess it was 64 or 60, late 64 and 65, I was retained by the Munoz family from Charlotte, Texas, who had been involved in an automobile accident. As a result of that accident, Mrs. Munoz's right leg was amputated. So I filed suit in Atascosa County. The county seat is in Jordanton, Texas. I took the case, prepared all my pretrial work. I reported for trial, and they showed me a copy of the jury list. There were no Mexicanos on the jury. So I went and complained to Judge Roberts, and he told me, he says, you know, I don't discriminate. I'm fair. I reset the case for August the 1st. August the 1st.
1966.
66. So August the 1st, I reported back for trial. They gave me a copy of the jury list. They had two Mexicanos. One had been dead for 10 years, and the other one didn't speak a word of Spanish. So as a result, I had no choice but to settle the case for a third of its actual worth. During this time, I was very, very upset. I had received correspondence from Jack Greenberg in the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, inviting me to their meetings. The NAACP Legal Defense Fund had received considerable amounts of money from foundations because of their victory in the Brown versus the State Board of Education. They invited me, and I never went. So finally, after the Munoz case, they sent me $500 to go to a conference in Chicago, a conference of civil rights lawyers. And again, they were going to prepare us with briefs, memorandums of law, sample complaints, how to file suits. And I sent Matt Garcia. I don't know if you remember, Matt Garcia was later a state representative from San Antonio, from Bexar County. Mm-hmm. And Matt went in my place, and he came back and says, give me a report. And he says, they have money, plenty of money. I called Jack Greenberg, and he suggested, he says, well, what we can do is I can come to San Antonio with a staff of our civil rights lawyers, and we can try the cases for the Mexican-American community. We will fight the cases for them, civil rights cases. So I said, well, why don't we organize a Mexican-American Legal Defense Fund? He says, that's a very good idea. He said, let me talk to some people at the Ford Foundation and call you back.
Let me ask you this.
Yes.
Why was it important for you to not just have people coming in to San Antonio to file the suits for you rather than you, MALDEF, being organized?
Well, it was important to the movement and to the cause and to the Mexican-American community to have our own lawyers fight our own cases. I felt that they were more closely related. They were close to the problems. They knew more about the problems than anybody else. And these were people from New York that were coming down here. They wouldn't have the expertise, I said, in Mexican-American social, economic, and cultural problems. So anyway, about 10 days later, Jack called me. He says, I'm going to send you $500 to come to New York. I've set up an appointment with a committee from the Ford Foundation. I was at the International Building. I was on the third floor. And on the second floor, Roy Padilla, who was a former city councilman, was there. Roy Padilla was an ultra-conservative with the Good Government League. He was the type of guy who didn't want to air the Mexican-American problems. He says, we'll resolve them for you. We'll do it quietly. Don't bring out the laundry, you know. And he had, the reason that I invited him to New York, he had a daughter who was a stewardess with American Airlines, so he could fly anywhere free. Then I invited Albert Pena, who was a commissioner, Albert Pena, who was the militant, the civil rights leader in San Antonio, very active. I invited him to come with me. He had no money, so I gave him my $500, and I paid my own way. And we went to New York City. We met at a restaurant, an Argentinian restaurant, with Bill Pincus, Jack Greenberg, and I forget the name of the other two gentlemen from the fort. And for about 2 hours, we told him about the problems of the Mexican-American communities, the school segregation, the non-participation in jury, employment discrimination. We talked about everything, all three of us, including Roy Padilla, who was an ultra-conservative. Towards the end of that conference, they told me that I needed $6,000 as seed money to start the proposal business. I said, we don't have it. Jack Greenberg says, wait a minute. He went to the phone, to a payphone, and called a friend of his at the Melton Foundation. And in 10 minutes, he was back. He says, I have your $6,000. He said, now we're going to talk about who's going to write the proposal. Well, my first thought was Dr. Joe Bernal, who was a teacher, extremely liberal, very active with the community. The second one was Pepe Cardenas, a PhD in education, very active in school segregation problems. And so I proposed those names. And Jack said, look, what we need is somebody that's close to Fort. This man's name is Finkelstein, Charles Finkelstein, I think. He was the statistician in the Brown versus State Board of Education. He is the one that won that case with the statistical data and research. And so I said, well, I have no quarrel. So Finkelstein was appointed to do the proposal, and they asked me to help him. The Ford Foundation, I came back, and about a week later, the Ford Foundation called me back to New York. I returned to New York, and they said, look, we presented a proposal of a civil rights organization for Texas, period. And they said, we have talked to Mr. Pincus, but we think that we would be interested in funding a civil rights organization for the Mexican Americans covering the entire Southwest. I mean, New Mexico, Arizona, California, and Colorado. So you amend whatever papers you're going to prepare. And secondly, says there must not be a competing proposal. We have problems with the Puerto Rican community because there were too many sections and factions in the community. Everybody wanted to lead. We deal with one. If there's a competing proposal, we will cancel you out. We'll close the book. So with that in mind, I returned to San Antonio. I drafted the Articles of Incorporation for the Mexican-American Legal Defense Fund. The charter members were Albert Pena, Roy Padilla, and myself. We incorporated. Then we needed a board of directors. So the board of directors were hand-picked. I called them all, and I said, look, we're going to request a proposal for $1 million. There is to be no disputes, no discussions, no meetings till after we get the money. And everybody agreed. And let me do the work. So then I had no money, so there was nothing else but to do but to drive. I didn't have the money to fly. So my wife drove me to New Mexico. And in New Mexico, Manuel Lopez, who used to be an associate of mine in law practice in San Antonio, was now with the SER program. SER was a national program dealing with employment for Mexican Americans, training and all of that. So I met with Manuel, and Manuel called the lawyers from New Mexico to meet with me. And they all came, every Mexican American lawyer I thought were Mexican Americans. As I was addressing them, I was talking about the Mexican American problems here and there and everywhere. And somebody raised his hand. He said, "Mr. Tejerina, we're not Mexican Americans in New Mexico. We're Spanish Americans." I said, "Well, look, for the time being, just go along with me. Wait till we get the money, then you can call yourself whatever you want." But they agreed. Dan Sosa, who was an assistant U.S. attorney, former assistant U.S. attorney, was recruited to be the board member from New Mexico. From there, I went to Arizona, and through the efforts of the LULACs, I met in Phoenix with several lawyers from Arizona, and they immediately came on top of the board. They offered no problems. They had no opposition. They were willing to cooperate. I went into Los Angeles, and the first thing I found out was that a man by the name of Bert Corona was working on a proposal to the Ford Foundation for a legal services organization. So I had met with an attorney, Herman Sias, and invited him to be a member of the board, and he took me to Bert Corona. So Mr. Bert Corona and I never forget that. We met at 10 o'clock, and we talked till 5 o'clock in the morning. We talked and we talked and we talked. Finally, we gave each other the abrazo, and he agreed to yield to the San Antonio group because what I was told is we don't want no damn Mexicanos from Texas telling Mexicanos from California what to do. So anyway, the other obstacle was Cesar Chavez. Cesar Chavez, what any money that comes from the Ford Foundation belongs to the farmers, workers, union. And I said, well, you know, we get to discuss with Caesar. We met with him. We discussed him. He agreed and yielded to us to proceed. From there, I came home. We drove back home. Then I did fly to Colorado and met with the lawyers there and invited three or four lawyers. One was from Pueblo, Colorado, and two from Denver. We came on the board. We came back, and then I had to go back again with Finkelstein. This time I flew because he had the money to fly. And the proposal was drafted, and then we waited, and we waited, and we waited, and we waited. We were almost giving up till we were called to attend a meeting, asked me to set a meeting at a hotel. I set the meeting at the Gunner Hotel, and Jack Greenberg and Bill Pincus came in, and they read the letter from the Ford Foundation. It says, "We're glad and happy to announce to you that the Ford Foundation is making a grant of $2,250,000. Remember, we had only asked for $1 million. So instead of $1 million, we got $2,250,000. Father Caso, Henry Caso, who then was a Catholic priest and later resigned, now lives in New Mexico. He was my right hand, you know, throughout all those that period. And we called all the board together, and Carlos Canena was appointed president to receive the check, the grant from the Ford Foundation. And the rest was history, you know. We went to work. And My first ambition or focus or I was angry. I was full of hate. Was to attack the jury system in Bexar County and the City Public Service Board. So those were the first two lawsuits that were filed. Another factor that was that everything helped us. I went. I learned that there was a program with Vista. Is that Vista? Vista Volunteer Lawyers. So I applied to the program, and then I got five Mexicans from New York. What was their name? They were all Jewish people. They were Jewish lawyers from the jail and Harvard. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were brilliant students of the law. So they came in. They required no training. It was a great pleasure for me to walk into court with my briefs already done. They would give me the briefs, the presentation, everything, and argue the case like if I had a 20-lawyer law firm. And I made a survey and found out that, like in San Antonio, there were 75 lawyers, and only five practiced in the federal courts.
75 Mexican-American lawyers?
Mexican-American. There were two, and then Roy Barrera left the district attorney's office, and he got a license in federal practice, so that H.F. Garcia, who is now a federal judge, mm-hmm. and I don't know who the other one was, but there was five. So I checked with New Mexico and Kelly. Same thing. Very few lawyers practice in federal court. They were mostly dealing in criminal law, divorces, real estate. So we needed to train them. So I applied for a grant of $75,000 to bring the Mexican-American lawyers in the five-state area to San Antonio. I filed a proposal, and I waited, and 3 or 4 months went by. I didn't hear a thing. I called Jack Greenberg, and he says, well, I know that there is the chairman of the board, who's retired, is living in Santa Fe, New Mexico. So I drove to Santa Fe, New Mexico, and met with this gentleman. And he says, well, that he had no influence in the foundation. But he says, Sergeant Schreiber, who's the ambassador of France, is a very close friend of this foundation. He's very well-liked. So I didn't know how in the world I could meet the Sergeant Schreiber. But the senator from New Mexico, I forget his name. Anyway, I went to his office in Washington, D.C., and I was welcomed with open arms. And they took me to the senator, and he instructed his executive secretary to call Paris and see if they can reach Sergeant Schreiber. Talked to him on the phone, then he gave me the phone. I explained my mission, my purpose. I needed help, I told him. He says, I don't know that I can help you, but I will try. So I came home, and I was very disappointed. I started looking through my papers, finding another foundation to apply for a grant. And in 10 days, I received a check for $75,000 from this foundation. We immediately sat around, invited all the lawyers in California, Arizona, Colorado, New Mexico, and Texas to come to a meeting. We rented a dude ranch in Bandera, Texas, and we gave them all copies of complaints to be filed in federal court, memorandums of law, briefs, brought lectures, people from professors of the law schools, and from then on, we acquired associates of MALDEV who could reach the greater community.
Why was it important for them to have this training to be able to argue their cases in federal court?
MALDEV didn't have that much money to file those states, and we would reach local sources in each state to file employment discrimination cases against the big corporations, which was exactly what was done. There was another interesting aspect of the beginning of MALDEV, and that was the scholarship. Mm-hmm. I had $250,000 for scholarships. couldn't reach. I had applications come in every day. So I called all the deans of the law schools in New Mexico, Arizona, California, and Colorado, and Texas, and invited them to the same dude ranch where we had the lawyers in Bandera. I paid their way, and they came, and I presented my case, and I remember that the only one who was very reluctant was the dean from St. Mary's University Law School. He did not want to participate. But there's a lot of friendship and interchange of relationships between the deans of the law schools. Some of them knew Dean Raba from St. Mary's, and they brought him in. At the end of the day, every single law school agreed to match funds with us. In other words, for every law scholarship we awarded to a Mexican-American to go to law school, we put half, and they would put half. You understand? Mm-hmm. So as a result, we were able to send a whole bunch of kids to law school, including Greg Luna's daughter went on a law school.
Let me backtrack just a couple of seconds. You talk about Jack Greenberg had contacted you and wanted to help you out in some way.
Yes.
How had Jack Greenberg heard about what was going on with Mexican-Americans in Texas?
I was with LULAC Council number 2, I was the state civil rights chairman. And every time there was a complaint to be filed, the press was very good to me. If I blast somebody, that's all we could do is pass a resolution and complain. They would throw it on the wastebasket. But I was making news all over the state as civil rights chairman, complaining about this and that and the other. Most of the publicity came when I attacked the grand jury selection system. Like in Texas, you had to be a property owner to serve on a jury. They had a jury commission system. The judge would appoint 3 jury commissioners, and they would select their buddies. It was a country club-type grand jury system. There was one Mexicano who served on all the juries named Henry Guerra. But Henry Guerra was a Canary Islander. He was not a Mexican. He was a Canary Islander. His name was Guerra, but his people came from the Canary Islands. And
the
funeral home, okay. Yes. And so I used to blast him. Henry's a good friend of mine now, but I used to blast him. And when Mulder filed suit against the judges in Bexar County, the legislature in Texas passed a law abolishing the requirement of property as a requisite of being a juror. And today, you know, more than 60% of the jurors are Mexican-American.
What year was that the law was passed?
66, 67, 68.
And the lawsuit that you referred to against Bexar County?
Same place. It was, in fact, we were in court. Mm-hmm. We were in court when the legislature passed that law. And, of course, that issue became moot. Okay, then the judge called, granted us a declaratory judgment, you know, saying that the composition of the juries was unconstitutional.
Okay. Earlier, when I was reading something else where it talks about there was a big ignorance outside of Texas of what was going on in Texas in the Southwest.
Yes.
Discrimination against Mexican Americans, and you talk about going to New York and explaining to Bill Pincus and Jack Greenberg some of the institutional racism.
They did not know. Of the Mexican-American community. People strictly from New York, Ivy League colleges, they knew nothing about our problems. We had to educate them. It didn't take 2-3 hours. It took more than that. You know, we wrote papers. I remember that I submitted jury lists. I submitted newspaper articles on school segregation cases and complaints, like Joe Bernal would complain about school segregation, bilingual, programs and all of that, and we could get nowhere.
But that it's not only true of. It seems like it's something that continued to happen for a long time.
Even
after that,
yes.
There's still a widespread ignorance of the systems that were in place in Texas and the Southwest. Why do you suppose that is? Why has there not been a lot of, you know, this is not part of the national consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people outside of Texas, and especially even people that are in Texas, don't know that of our history. Why do you suppose that this isn't part of our history books and our sociology books? And
I don't know. It just has. I think things are changing now. In fact, I read recently where there are over 1,000 Mexican Americans living in Maine, and they're having problems. Did you read that? Yeah, they're having problems. They went there as migrant workers, mm-hmm. and they're staying there. But you know, Bill Pincus, Jack Greenberg, and the other gentlemen on the committee, they had never heard of the problems that Mexicanos were having.
But Jack Greenberg had invited you to.
Because he read about my in the papers. Mm-hmm. You understand? In other words, the black community would send them copies. This is what he told me. Mm-hmm. There was another way he found about me. Vilma Martinez, a San Antonio native, was working for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund as a lawyer trainee. Mm-hmm. And she also was instrumental in getting me to New York.
Okay. Now, I forget what year you started practicing law?
51.
And in 54, I guess there was the Hernandez case that said that there shouldn't be discrimination, that there should be Mexicanos on juries.
Yes.
And yet, in 1966, you were still seeing that had not translated. What was the gap there? You know, something happens in 54. It says that it's not constitutional.
Well, what would happen in Jackson County. That never in the history of Jackson County had they ever called a Mexican American to serve on the jury. In Bexar County, they would have Henry Guerra on the jury. See, so, and he was a Canary Islander. So what we were alleging that was tantamount to no representation at all. And it took several years to overcome all of that, you know. I don't know the establishment, or embedded racism, anti-Mexican feelings in the community, in the Anglo community. In 1970, 71, I argued a case in San Angelo on school segregation in a place out of Junction, Texas, where they have those caves, Sonora, mm-hmm. Sonora, Texas. They had the main school, and across a creek, across from the main school, was a frame building with a big sign, Mexican School. This was in 71. So the federal judge gave me an order closing the segregated school and sent two marshals with me to Sonora. When we got to Sonora, I can tell you a story. We got to Sonora, there were about 1,000 people, Mexicanos, greeting me, and they put the abrazo on me, and they said they loved me, and we closed the school. I'm the champion of Sonora. The clock turns, see? In 82 and 81, I'm running for office for the Court of Appeals, and Sonora is in one of my districts. I got 85 votes in Sonora. You know what happened was all the people graduated school and they left.
Yeah.
They would leave. All the people that had been there had already been gone.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a new generation anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But that was practically the last school segregation, serious, you know, problem, yeah, in Sonora, Texas.
We've talked to a lot of people of this generation, and sometimes when they're telling us about incidents that they saw as they were growing up, one of the things that we hear a lot is, that's just the way it is. You know, they would be turned away from some place, or they would be going to the lousy schools, and they'd say, well, that's just the way it is.
Yes.
How much of that was part of the problem that it took so long to finally, you know, that there had to be an organization created to enforce.
You see, that we had no money to fight the cases. You understand? Like, LULAC was a national organization, but the one organization that was the leader in the movement that sponsored the cases, that raised the money, was LULAC Council Number 2 in San Antonio. When the Peter Hernandez case came up, LULAC Council made raffles, dances. They sold stuff, you know, like flea markets, trying to raise money to give.
You were talking about the efforts of LULAC Council Number 2 and raising money for the
FNAC. Yeah, LULAC Council Number 2 was instrumental in raising most of the money. The Salvatierra case in Eagle Pass was fought by MC Gonzalez. Again, money raised by LULAC. The biggest problem that not only we did not have the legal arm of the movement, we had no representation in the city council and the school boards, and we needed any Mexicano that ran at large would defeat it. He couldn't win, you see, and so Maldev was the one who went into court and opened up those doors. I mean, the law was with us, but in other words, the establishment was not going to come in and say, look, or Texas, the state of Texas, had to be forced into opening the doors by the federal government, by the 14th Amendment that was blessed for us. Every single case had an aspect with the 14th Amendment. The challenge was based on the 14th Amendment. Now we have members in every school board, in the city council, and county commission, and all those problems, they were bad. The problems were bad. Like in Jackson County, they had restrooms for Mexicanos separate from Anglos, and the schools were segregated. The Cuero Independent School District in 48 asked the Attorney General, under what basis can we legally segregate the Mexican children in the public schools of Cuero? Bryce Daniel was the Attorney General. And I remember the day that Eddie Dyer was working at the courthouse, at the Capitol, at the state Capitol. He was an intern at the state Capitol. And he brought me a copy of the opinion by Bryce Daniel, says, read this. So I read it. Hey, perfect. The Attorney General says you cannot legally segregate Mexicanos. Says, read it again. So in the second paragraph, it stated, it says, you cannot legally segregate the Mexican children in the public schools of Cuero, but for pedagogical reasons, you can place them in separate rooms. And I stood up, and we organized a group at the University of Texas. We had the Laredo Club. We had 100 Mexicanos from Laredo. We had the Alba Club, which had about 500 members from throughout South Texas. So I organized a group, and we went to and picketed Price Daniel's house. Later, I went to Dr. George Sanchez, a professor at the University of Texas, and we invited Price Daniel to debate because he called and called and said that we had it wrong and that he didn't mean it. So we challenged him to a debate. Gus Garcia was the moderator. We met at the Hogg Auditorium at the University of Texas. Gus Garcia was the moderator, and the debaters were Dr. George Sanchez and Price Daniels.
What year was this?
This was in 48. I remember that I had heard of a militant guy in San Antonio named Henry Gonzalez, who was unemployed. He had been fired as a juvenile officer. So I called Henry and asked him to come, and he came to Hogg Auditorium. That is where I met Henry Gonzalez for the first time. And he participated at the debate, and ask very pointed questions to Price Daniels. Well, anyway, to make a long story short, that was the end of segregation in Cuero Independent School District.
What difference did it make to have McDonald's on the juries and on the grand juries? Okay. You were going to tell a story?
Oh, yeah.
Go ahead.
We're on?
Yeah.
Sometime during 70-71, high school Mexican-Americans walked out in protest claiming discrimination by the Abilene High School. The girls were bypassed for cheerleaders and various other school programs. So they walked out, and the school expelled them, mm-hmm. not suspended them, expelled them. We filed a lawsuit in Abilene in federal court, and there was a firebrand lawyer from Lubbock that came and filed a lawsuit, and we paid him. But instead of helping, he antagonized the whole community. So I went down there, and Judge Brewster from Fort Worth was sitting in Abilene, and I knew the judge. And I had to substitute counsel and remove the guy. We tried the case for a week before a jury. Finally, we reached an agreement whereby the children were reinstated in school. And we waived money damages. We weren't interested. But the thing that were reinstated in school. And all of them went back to school. All of them finished school. And the leader, and I forget her name, it's Mexicanita. She went on to university, graduated, went to medical school. And I understand that today she is a brain surgeon. So maybe somebody in your department could trace her down in Abilene. I got a newspaper clipping in Margo's office at the University of Texas on that case. We won that case. They were all reinstated. But this particular impresses me. And I don't have the resources nor the health to pursue it. And, you know, it would be a nice story. It would make a very nice story.
Let me just ask you one last thing, and then I will let Mara Robbins take over. But you talked about the City Public Service Board and how you were very upset at them.
The Public Service Board had no Mexicanos or Mexicanos employed. One of the requirements to climb a post, you had to be 5'10 or 5'11. That excluded most of the Mexicanos at that time. And they had a club. They had a very private club paid for with tax money. And no Mexicanos were admitted in there.
Excuse me, the City Public Service Board, what was it exactly?
Public utilities. And it was a city-owned facility. It was a city-owned project.
They were good paying, stable jobs.
Yes. What happened in that case, we filed suit, and the judge called the lawyers and called us all into chambers. And he told them that he wanted us to give him a list of every job where no Mexicano had been employed or denied employment. And he said he gave them 30 days to correct it, and they did correct it. And they started employing Mexicanos. Today, they're... Ruben Escobedo was a member of the board for many, many years. Some of the top employees were Mexicanos.
I lied. I've got to ask you a couple more questions about when you were going around and you were talking to these lawyers in New Mexico, Colorado. You had mentioned earlier before we started taping about Reyes Tijerina.
Right.
Was there conformity there? Did he agree with the goals of
Moldova? Yes, there were two militants, Corky Gonzalez in Denver and Reyes Tijerina in New Mexico. Reyes was claiming that all the lands had been stolen from the Mexicans by the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, and he was demanding that some of those choice lands be given back, did it to the Indians and the Mexicans. Corky Gonzalez in Denver would bring in 5,000 people on the street attacking police brutality. That was the main focus of the movement in Denver, police brutality. Corky Gonzalez asked me for one thing. He says, get me a typewriter. I bought him a typewriter. And he yielded. They joined us. You understand? They provided us with research, statistics, and cases, and civil rights problems, and all of that.
How did you get the word out? There were these people all over the lawyers all over the place. How was it possible for you to know who was working as an attorney in California and New Mexico? And
through the LULACs. Through the LULACs. The LULAC organization, by the time I arrived at a city, the LULACs had already had a group waiting for me. They were very instrumental.
I will stop here and I will yield tomorrow.
Okay, go ahead. This is the time to do it.
Okay, this is Mauro Robbins sitting again with Pete Tiarina. It's December 3rd, 2000. Thanks again for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you, sir.
Picking up on something that Maggie asked about earlier, you'd mentioned that when you were first getting the funding for from the Ford Foundation for MALDEF, that Cesar Chavez had been sort of defensive about wanting the Ford Foundation money to go to the UFW. How did you get his support of MALDEF?
We met and we talked, and I was lucky because at that time, one of the Kennedys, I forget whether it was Robert Kennedy, got him some money. Got him a grant or some money contributions from the East to his program. And what I tried to convince Caesar was that the civil rights problems with the Mexican-American community had to be addressed, and we needed some priority on that. His farm workers' union was already well-organized, well-funded at that time, and they were meeting with great success. And I told him that if there were any legal fights to be waged by the Farm Workers Union, that we would collaborate with him. And on that basis, he agreed not to file a protest or make a request for allocation of funds from the Ford grant.
And you eventually did file some suits on behalf of UFW?
We never did. We were never asked. But that doesn't mean we weren't ready, you see.
Okay. The rest, most of what I'm going to ask you for is sort of biographical information leading up from the very beginning to through law school up just before the start of MALDEF.
Okay.
It's a lot of time, a lot of material. So probably the areas I know that you've told me about before that I know I'd like to hear more about are some of your time in the Conservation Corps and the Civilian Military Training Corps. I think you told me once about a protest you led while you were in there, as well as also your military time, and then your education in terms of at UT, Southwest, St. Mary's. Those are the areas I know I want to to make sure we have time for. But let's start at the beginning. Where were your parents born, and what did they do?
In Laredo. My father was a truck driver.
And your mother?
My mother was unemployed, a housewife.
Okay. Also from Laredo?
Also from Laredo, yes.
Okay, how many children did they have?
Two. Yes.
Yourself and
Minerva, my sister.
Okay. And what language did you speak at home?
Spanish. Yeah.
Your parents spoke English, though?
No.
No,
I didn't speak English that I practically left San Antonio. I mean, left Laredo. Because even in school, we spoke Spanish. The teachers were all Mexican.
And where did you learn, where did you pick up the English?
Well, actually, I knew, in school. But I mastered it when I left in the service, I guess.
And can you tell me about tell me about your home, your childhood home there in Laredo. Did your folks, did they own it? How many rooms did it have? Just
we had a three-bedroom home. We were poor, you know. My dad, what he would do mostly before the war, he would move furniture, move people from, as a house mover. And we would get paid about 75 cents every time we moved the house. A dollar and a quarter would be too much. So, you know what, I don't know if I remember telling you that in 1937, I heard of a program in Ken Bullis, in San Antonio, Ken Bullis, Texas, for the Citizens Military Training Corps. So I joined. They were offered to pay $15 for the month.
So how old were you then?
Well, I was 15, and you had to be 17 to be. So I joined. I was accepted. And then about 2 weeks after I was accepted, they found out I was not 17. So they sent me home. And I had to go to the market at the San Antonio Terminal Market and find a watermelon truck going to Laredo that I got a ride on. I went back to high school, and the following July, I enrolled again in the Citizens Military Training called CMTC. And what that was, that for 30 days, they would give you intensive training as an infantryman. In July, we had wool leggings, wool shirts, and we would march up and down those country roads like around Camp Bullis. At the end of the six-week period, we had a 10-mile march with full field pack. I learned I became an expert rifleman. I could clean and work on my gun blindfolded. I was promoted to the Red Corps, which was the second year. The second year I came to the Red Corps, which was in 38. And I was, we were broke. Times got real bad. So I applied to go to the Citizens Conservation Corps, CCC camp. And I remember that I went to Judge M.J. Raymond and asked him, because they wouldn't accept me because my father had a truck, an old truck. So he got me waived and got some waivers and got me into the CCC camp, and they sent me to Pflugerville. It was a sort of a conservation, farm conservation program. We built fences, we planted sod, things like that. And there were about, the camp consisted of about 200 members, 200 service people. There were a staff sergeant, a second lieutenant, and a captain. And I remember that, there were about 75 Mexicanos. I was the one with the highest education. I had 2 years of high school. 1.5 year of high school at that time. So I became the spokesman for the group. One day they announced over the public address system, it says, all Mexicans must have a crew haircut, a 2-inch haircut. And we all left, went to work. One guy named Rufus Jimenez from Arizona had been there about 18 months without going home. He was given a furlough, so he remained in the barracks ready for them to take him to the bus station in Austin. When we came back at 5 o'clock, Rufus was still there, and he was crying. The lieutenant, Lieutenant Gilmore, an ex-football player from Arkansas, grabbed him and shaved the middle of his hair. He looked horrible, in just the middle of the hair shaved, and his hair on the side. And he didn't want to go home looking like that. So all the Mexicanos got together and asked me to ask to protest, to ask for a meeting. So I went to company headquarters, and I asked the sergeant that we Mexicanos wanted a meeting with the commanding officer. So we all went into the recreation hall and sat there. And after a while, in comes the sergeant with the captain and the lieutenant. And the captain says, "Who in the hell is the guy who asked for this meeting?" So I stood up, and for about 15, 20 minutes, he cursed the hell out of me. Told him what was I doing trying to tell him how to run his camp, and this and that, and told me that he wanted me to go home, that he didn't want me there anymore, and that he was going to give me an administrative discharge, not a dishonorable, an administrative discharge. This was in October. So he sent me home, and I went back and rolled back in school and finished that semester. Go ahead.
Can we just, was that the first time that you had stood up and challenged?
Yes.
Challenged him and spoken out like
yes,
that?
Yes, yes.
Were you nervous when he comes in that room and says, who asked for this meeting?
Yes. Well, I was. I was scared. But, see, after he got through blasting the hell out of me, he told us, "What are you Mexicans worried about?" He says, "You've been having a dance once a month. I tell you what. From now on, the Mexicans will have two dances a month." They would bring in girls from Austin to dance with the service people. And they all applauded the captain, and I was left there by myself. Well, anyway, I went back to Laredo. I finished the semester.
Go ahead. Actually, before we get there, I still want to understand a few things.
Yeah.
Just only the Hispanics had to get haircuts?
Yes. Well, the Mexicans, of course.
Was that because there were only Hispanics in the unit, or was that because what
that was the I was the order. All Mexicans will have a crew haircut. What, I don't know, you understand?
Okay. What kind of hair did the Anglos have?
Well, God only knows. It's regular haircuts.
Okay, so, I'm sorry, can you keep telling me, so you went back to Laredo after
Went to Laredo, I finished the spring semester. In July, I went back to Citizens Mediterranean Camp. By that time, I was called what is known as a white student. I was a platoon commander. I had 36 soldiers under my command, under my platoon. And we went through the rigorous training. And in my platoon was a young kid named Sullivan, John Sullivan. I never associated him with anything. At the end of the camp, under 6 weeks, we had what is called a regimental parade and visitors' day. The parents would come in and see the regimental parade with a band from the 2nd Division. The people who trained us were 2nd Division soldiers. Professional soldiers been in the Army for 20 years. So anyway, the commanding officer came to me. He says, "Pete, you guys have done a good job. Why don't you pick up some volunteers and keep the street clean?" And we had a duffel bag in the middle of the street, blister bag they call it, full of ice water. So when the troops came in, they would have drink cold water. And the visitors would come in at the end of the regimental parade. I needed some ice, and Johnny Sullivan volunteered to go get the ice. When the visitors were coming in, this Captain Sullivan that had thrown me out of the CCC camps was John Sullivan's father. So he saw his son with a block of ice marching down the street. He says, "Who ordered you to do this? Who's in charge here?" It's Pete Tejerina, Sergeant Pete Tejerina. So he came and he cursed me again and trusted me and filed a complaint with General Kruger of the 2nd Division that I had discriminated against his son and I had abused him and this and the other, that it was brutal, that I had him doing hard labor. And so I was called in before the committee and I was in line for the next year. I was going to be a blue student. I could take the extension courses and become a second lieutenant in the infantry. And my My intended purpose at the time was to become a second lieutenant with the infantry. Well, they did not. They
shut this door.
I'm sorry.
The crowd's getting pretty big outside that parade.
You want to shut this door over here too? Want me to shut it?
No, that one.
I can hear noise coming from that
one. Any shutting of doors would help in any direction. Okay, we got Speedy. Do you want to ask him that question again, just to prompt him? That'd be good.
Okay. Well, actually, could you back up for a second and tell me? Well, maybe we were just getting to this or talking about this, but why did you want to join this civilian military training in the first place? What was the
attraction? First, it was an effort to get away from home and meet people from all over the state. There were high school students from all over the state coming to this military training program. And it was an easy... I looked for the Army as a lifetime. You know, I thought of joining the Army and just stay there. And I had the training. I considered myself a first-class infantryman. And so the board rejected me because of Captain Sullivan's complaints. So I went back home, and this happened in 1939, 1940. I went back to school, and again, times were rough. So August the 1st, I decided that I was going to go to the Air Force. I didn't want to go to the infantry. Then I thought of survival, you understand? So I joined the Air Force and stayed in the Air Force from 41 until December the 23rd when I was discharged.
So when you joined up...
Of 45.
You joined up August of 41?
Yes.
So before Pearl Harbor.
Before.
You know, did you think by then that you would be going to war anyway?
I would have been drafted. I would have been drafted.
And so you thought it was going to happen inevitably.
Right. In other words, August the 4th, I became 18. And so I was a military guard at Brooks Field for about 2 years out the gate. And other than that, you know, my service was uneventful, and I went overseas to Guam in July of 45 as a propeller specialist. I was trained at the Curtis Wright Propeller School, and by then the propellers were going out of business. The jets were coming in.
What was the propeller specialist do?
They remove the propeller and take the dome off and re-oil it and repack it and stuff like that.
Which unit and battalion and company were you assigned with?
I was with the 20th Air Force. I think it's 359th Air Engineers or something.
And how many people were you serving with?
In my company,
Mm-hmm.
About 200.
And what was the makeup of that? Who were your fellow soldiers or airmen?
Who were they?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're all soldiers. I don't know what you mean.
They all come from?
From all over the...
They all come from Laredo?
No, they were from all over the country.
Okay.
All over the country.
And in terms of...
Is that phone going to bother you? Is that phone going to bother the interview segment here? It's going to ring for...
No, it's gone.
Okay.
And what was the ethnic makeup of the company?
Well, I think there was... I was the only Mexican in that company.
Was that ever any kind of issue or?
No. Most of the people were from New York, from back east, you know, Italians and Jewish from New York area. There was I acquired a close relationship and friendship with a soldier by the name of Wilkes Coffey from Murfreesboro, Tennessee. And we would be traveling up and down the ramp going to fix the propellers with oil in our ears and our noses, and we used to address each other as Senator. Wilkes Coffey went back to Murfrees. He went to law school and became a judge. And I think he served in Congress as a representative. I haven't talked to him in about 4 or 5 years, but he's still alive. And I came back and I went to law school there.
And so did you, during that time in the service, did you ever see or feel any institutionalized discrimination?
No, none whatsoever.
Or how about just the personal between soldiers?
No, never.
None at all?
Never, none at all.
I guess, can you tell me what way that your time in the service affected you?
Well, I did a lot of reading. I read. I read a book called by Irvin Stone. It was a book on Clarence Darrow. And that sort of guided me towards law. The book was Clarence Darrow fighting for the oppressed and the poor. And I thought, you know, that maybe this is where I belong.
Did you already have some sense of the about discrimination
Well, you see, I didn't know about discrimination till much later years in Laredo. There's no discrimination. It's 99% Mexican at that time, you know. There was no discrimination there. The discrimination.
Let's back up for a second and talk about your time in the service. You said you were the only Hispanic in your company. Did you ever get a chance to speak Spanish anywhere?
Yes, there were Mexican Americans in other units. And we would meet throughout, especially when we were in Guam. When we were in Guam, we would meet at, I remember one guy from Los Angeles had a record player and one record. And when I was arriving in Guam and we were marching up to our camping area, somebody hollered at me in Spanish, "Hey, where are you from?" I said, "San Antonio." I said, "So am I." It was a guy out in the jungle, and he had a bootlegging business in Guam. He was making jungle juice out of the fruits and everything he found out in the jungle. And he had a batch of country homemade whiskey or something. And later on we would meet. And I remember one day we had all met. And to speak Spanish, you know, to get together. And we had a Japanese ship drop. They would come in about every night and drop one bomb. Well, this one bomb hit the house before we got there and killed this guy from Los Angeles who was our host.
What was the record?
Todo una vida. Todo una vida. It was the only record. We played it and played it and played it. But In the service, I remember an incident I was being discharged. We came into Fort Sam Houston, and we had huge barracks. And there was a Mexicano friend of mine sitting next to me, and there was a guy across from me with blonde hair and green eyes. And we're all eating, you know. People came from groups and said whatever you could find. And this guy was always joking with me. He says, "The trouble with you is that Tijerinas ain't worth a damn." This buddy of mine told me that. See? So this guy across the street, he says, "Hey, buddy, I'm a Tijerina." He was from Brownsville. And he was more of a Spaniard. You understand? I never forget that.
And what happened?
No, nothing. We all laughed, you know.
Okay. So how about you spent most of your time over here, right, in the States during your service?
Yes.
Okay. And then was there opportunity to speak Spanish?
In the service?
Yes,
there was.
But funny, but okay. You were telling me about, I guess, well, about how you didn't, growing up in Laredo, there was no sense of discrimination because it was 99%.
Right. Mexican.
I guess, I was curious, you mentioned earlier that you took on the jury system first, that you said your phrase was you were full of hate towards the jury system.
Yes.
When did you first feel that kind of hate?
Well, when I was started practicing law in 51, and almost immediately I started trying, I became a criminal trial lawyer. And, you know, I could firsthand see the discrimination, the ability to get a fair shake from a jury. You know, supposed to be judged by your peers of your community. And certainly those jurors were not the peers of my clients, who were poor people from the West Side.
And how could you tell? I mean, besides looking at them, was there a way you could tell?
In their judgments, they wouldn't hesitate, but render a guilty verdict. They wouldn't listen to them.
Okay. Let's pick up from where you, when your military service, where you went after the military service, and when it ended, and where you went.
When I left the service, I was discharged in December of 45. I went to Laredo. I stayed in Laredo December, and I went in January. I went to see the principal of the high school, and I only had 2 years of actual high school, 2.5 years. So J.W. Nixon was the principal, and I talked to him. He says, Pete, if you pass the entrance exam to Texas, I'll give you a high school diploma this semester. So at that time, we had accelerated semesters, 3 semesters a year. So I went over there, and I talked to them, and they gave me some multiple answer questions. You know, I passed it immediately, and I was admitted, and he gave me a diploma. I never did participate in I never received a diploma, but officially he did give me a diploma. I did graduate from high school. I stayed at Texas 46 and 47, and in 48 I left Texas and went to Laredo, and went to the Laredo Junior College. I had to bring up my grade average to be admitted to law school.
What made you go back when you got out of the service, made you go back to school? Certainly a lot of your peers didn't do that.
Well, I wanted to, like I told you, I had done a lot of reading in the service, especially the last year. And I was unassigned. And in Guam, the war was practically over. So all I did all day long was read. So when I got home, I had saved about $1,500. And I told my father, he says, you want to, we'll buy a new truck and I'll go to work with you. He says, no, go on to school. I told him I want school. I had applied to Southwest University in Houston, to St. Mary's, and to DePaul University for law school. I was admitted on all three. So when I left Laredo, I went to Corpus to Houston. I arrived in Houston about 10, 11 o'clock at night. I walked around the town, and the law school was at the YMCA building. And on an impulse, I got on the bus and headed to San Antonio and went to St. Mary's Law School.
Let's back up. Where did this reading come from? I mean, lots of people don't read. Where did you?
They had books at libraries.
Okay.
Yeah, they had libraries. Army Library, Air Force Library.
Did every soldier read a lot?
No. There was few of us who read.
So what started it for you? Where did you learn to?
Kill time, I guess. I started killing time reading, like I told you, I read Darrow for the Defense by Irvin Stone. And that kind of, you know, stirred me up. Then I started reading, I read Freedom Road. I read a lot of books. I even started to read Mein Kampf. They had a copy there.
Okay. And but did you fit before you started applying for law school? Did you finish at UT?
No. I just took my pre-law there. See, when I left UT in May of 48, I had a C average, and they wanted a B average to go to law school. So I went to Laredo and went to the Laredo Junior College the very first year. And I took economics, I took history and math or something. Anyway, but I got excellent grades, and they accepted my grades from there. And that gave me the admission to the law school.
As soon as you got out of the service, you already knew you wanted to be a lawyer?
Yes, I wanted to.
So tell me about getting into law school.
Well, I came to St. Mary's.
And you said, what made you leave Houston and come to San Antonio?
I don't know, it was an impulse. Oh, St. Mary's is in San Antonio.
Right, did you see something in Houston you didn't like? Or?
I don't know, I just, like I told you, I got there at 10 o'clock at night. By 12 o'clock, I was on the bus to San Antonio. San Antonio had a campus. Over there was at the YMCA building. I had talked to some other people going to St. Mary's, and there was a woman who had a two-story house and had bunk beds. And we paid her, say, like $30, $35 a month and gave us two meals a day. The law school was at the St. Mary's Church on Crockett Street, I think, College Street, right where the, behind the Majestic Theater, there was a hot dog stand. I would eat hot dogs three times a day, 10 cents, so I wouldn't go home, you know.
How were you paying for this? Was the GI Bill part of this?
Yeah, GI Bill would give me $90 a month, substance.
And where were the rest?
The rest, many times I borrowed a dollar here and borrowed a dollar there. I remember Judge Beery. Judge Beery is a federal judge. His father, Sam, was in law school with me. And towards the end of the month, I would ask him, "Hey, Sam, lend me a dollar." Well, with a dollar, I would eat 3 days.
So you tell me how you talked about being going to law school in two different cities.
Well,
tell me about that.
In the spring semester of 48, I received a letter from the government that this was my last semester. My GI Bill would expire in May. So, and I had 56 hours at St. Mary's Law School. You could graduate and you could take the bar exam with 72 hours of law school. So, I was working for the State Department of Public Welfare full time, so I enrolled in St. Mary's, and I had a case of criminal law on Tuesdays, and on Thursdays I had criminal procedure. I went to Houston, I enrolled, and I took a course on Tuesday on Monday night. And Friday night and Saturday morning in Houston, three courses. So Monday morning, the people at work, and these were all Anglos, you understand? They loved me. They said, "Pete, take off." At 3 o'clock, I would go out like I was going to do work some cases, and I would drive to Houston. I would arrive in Houston, I'd go to class from 7 to 10. I'd drive back. Tuesday morning, I work all day. Tuesday night, I went to law school here in St. Mary's. Wednesday, I work all day. Thursday night, I went to law school at St. Mary's. Friday, I worked till 3 o'clock and left for Houston. And a class from 7 to 10, and slept in the car. And then the following morning, I had a class from 9 to 12. There was the Houston paper had a front page article of me that I had traveled, I don't know how many, hundreds of thousands of miles in that semester. And I would drive back Saturday morning. And at the end of May, I made my grade average in Houston was 87. Okay? My grade average at St. Mary's was 77. They wouldn't accept the grades from Houston. I could have graduated if they had accepted the grades from Houston. They wouldn't accept them, so they gave me, suspended me for scholastic reasons. I was suspended May of 51. I went and appeared before the bar committee. Judge Morrison was the chairman of the board. He lived in San Antonio. And told him that, you know, my problem, that my GI Bill had expired, that I wanted to take the bar exam. He said, well, change your application to say that you finished law school, your law studies in the law office. Find you a lawyer. And it's okay. So I changed it. And I remember I was walking down St. Mary's in front of the Empire Theater, right by the church. And Jimmy Tafoya was coming by the opposite way. Jimmy Tafoya was a municipal court judge, an old-time lawyer from San Antonio. I said, why are you so sad? So I told him what my problem was. He said, I need to find a law office. He took out some keys. He said, here. He's at the Aztec building. He says, there's cases. You do whatever you want. You come in anytime you want to. That's your office. So I went to his office and read some law. I had to take the bar exam in July of 48. You understand that this is only June. All this happened in June. They gave me permission to take the bar. I was still working for the State Welfare Department. So I went to five loan companies and borrowed $15 from each loan company. Those signature loan companies. I borrowed $15. I rented a room at the Robert Lee Hotel right across the street and got all my books. And for 30 days, I didn't leave. I just studied day and night. There was a coffee shop downstairs. For 30 days, I went and took a bar exam, and I got a better grade than the guys on the dean's list from St. Mary's. You know, passed it the first time.
Let me ask you, at this point in time, what percentage of the class was Mexican-American or in your law schools?
Ooh, I say 15%, 20%, something like that. Okay. Yeah.
All right. And so after you passed the bar, what did you do next?
I went to practice.
What kind of practice?
I joined the LULAC organization in Austin in 48 when I was at the University of Texas, when we had this problems with Attorney General Price Daniels. And then I transferred my membership to San Antonio LULACs. And there was an old-time lawyer named Albert Pena and Marcos Artucci. They had a small practice. They practiced real estate. They did divorces, adoptions. And he said, you can have an office here with me. And I had one coat and two pair of pants with holes in them. So he said, let me take you to a friend of mine. So we walked one block to Commerce Street. His office was on Dolorosa, right across from City Hall. And he introduced me to Max Banners. He says, this is Pete. He's with the LULACs. He's a brand new lawyer. He has no money. Well, Max Banners gave me two brand new suits, five shirts, ties, shoes, socks. He says, pay me whenever you can. You understand? Max Banner, a Jewish guy. So from then on, I just went to practice. And there was a lawyer named Pat Henley, Theo Pat Henley, who was the court clown, but he was brilliant. He was brilliant on cross-examination. He tried criminal cases galore. He had no money, and he had no car. So I was talking to Pat one day, and I received my license December the 7th of 51. I started practicing January the 1st of 52. We're talking about maybe 30 days later. I meet Pat Henley. He says, I got a murder case. Will you help me? I says, how much money you got, Pat? He says, well, they paid me $800 and I blew it. I don't have any money. So, but I had a car, see? So I still work. I had been working for the welfare department. So we went and talked to the witnesses and everything else. And this was called the TV murder case in San Antonio. The people were at a bar watching the television, watching the fights. And this guy walked all the way across the bar. And as this guy says, turn around. And when the guy turned around, he shot him. He backed up. He says, anybody next? He says, nobody wanted him. He walked out. So this was the client. So Albert Trevino, my patron saint who gave me this office, he says, you're not going to try that murder case. You have no experience. He said, well, I've got to learn somehow. So 30 days after I was trying a capital case in the criminal district court with Pat Henley. I'll never forget that. The guy was given life imprisonment, and I went home crying. But after that, you know, I started going to federal courts. I took any case. I got an appointment by the court. I asked for special permission. And so I became a criminal lawyer, and it took me 6 months. Learned by trial and error.
Can we back up? Can I ask you, in law school, tell me about how you first became aware of LULAC and how you came to join?
LULAC?
Yeah.
Well, I joined LULAC in council number, I remember the LULAC council in Austin. That's where I joined LULAC. I became very active with the LULAC council in Austin. Laredo had one of the strongest LULAC councils in the country. But Laredo also had an elite group of Mexican Americans. And the masses were poor. I belonged with the masses of poor. I would have never been accepted to the LULACs in Laredo. But I joined in Austin, and I liked the work they were doing, and the meetings and the friendship and all of that, the closeness together, called each other brothers. So when I came to Austin, I applied to council number two.
You mentioned there were some problems with the dean or something?
The dean of law? Well, the Dean Raba is the one who discharged me, suspended me from school.
Because?
But a scholastic. I didn't have the average, the B average.
Is this something that the LULAC was this some form of discrimination in there?
No, we never did. No. I didn't. I see, without the grades from Houston, I didn't have the average.
Well, it sounds like then you already focused on different forms of discrimination then.
Yeah, at that point in law yes.
School. So if you didn't have it in Laredo, leaving Laredo, when did you develop it and where?
Develop what?
I guess the sense of discrimination.
When I came to San Antonio, I got with the LULACs, you get exposed to it. People who suffer discrimination, their only hope of satisfaction would be the LULAC Council. They would complain to the LULAC. They would appear before us. Every Friday, we would have people coming in, complaining of discrimination. They were wrongfully terminated. They were evicted from here. They were denied admission here and admission there. And we had in LULAC Council number two, and I became a member of the traveling squad. And we would go to Cotula and to Crystal City and everywhere to fight discrimination cases. And everywhere we went, we saw the segregation at that time.
When you say fight them,
switch the camera battery.
I'd like you to actually sort of repeat what you told Mr. Dugan a moment ago when he asked you about what you learned or what the military taught you coming out of Laredo, where it was virtually Mexican American.
Well, as a Mexican American going into a new environment, the military, with people from all over the country, I felt no semblance of being distinguished as different. You know, of course, we all spoke English, and I dedicated myself to mastering and getting a good command of the English language. I had no problem. I don't recall a single incident of discrimination against a Mexican American soldier.
And what did that experience teach you?
Well, that I was a first class citizen. You know, that was an American. The Italians from New York, you understand, became very close to us. There was an instant relationship, you understand? Maybe because we both came from ethnic groups that at once had suffered discrimination. Great buddies.
Did you have Anglo friends that were not Italians?
Yes. I remember one incident. I was transferred to Helena, Montana, with the 1st Special Service Force, consisting of Canadians and Americans. They were paratroopers that were being trained to just jump on a Japanese-held island off of Alaska, Kisco, or I don't remember what, Aleutian Islands. And a crew from the Air Force came into Helena, Montana, and we all had fur-lined gloves and fur-lined coats. And those guys with paratroopers had just the necessary basics, very cool. So we were at a beer joint. We were drinking, and a guy came and pulled me from the shoulder. "Hey, I understand you don't like Canadians, damn you." I says, "Hell no." Punched me, and somebody held him from behind. He says, "Leave him alone. He's my buddy." "Your buddy, Cisco?" "Yeah." It was a guy from Laredo named Ralph Martinez called Cisco Kid. They called him the Cisco Kid. This guy was unusually big for a Mexican. He was a great fighter, especially a fist fighter. And apparently he was well known by his paratroopers, you know. So we all became buddies, you know, but this was a beer drinking brawl, you know.
We were talking earlier before the tape ended about your work with LULAC.
Mm-hmm.
When you talk about going for MALDEF, going around with LULAC and fighting discrimination, what way did you fight?
We wrote a resolution. We appeared before city councils, county commissioners, school boards, you know, the police department to protest the problems that were brought before us, police brutality, suspension from school, school segregation. You understand? All we could do was protest. We had no money and no lawyers who would fight our cases.
What kind of results did you get?
Nothing. They told us they would say we would work on it, we would take your complaint into consideration, and we'll try to put a stop to it. But like I tell you, they threw the resolution in the wastebasket, and that was the end of it.
Okay. You were on a statewide, a state committee?
I was state chairman.
Okay.
State civil rights chairman for the LULAC organization.
How did that happen?
I was appointed at a state convention. Every year, the LULACs throughout the state of Texas have a meeting, a convention, a state convention. Subsequent to that, there's a national convention where they all meet. They all send delegates.
And why you?
I don't know. I guess I was a lawyer, and I was the one raising hell in San Antonio, and they picked me to do it.
What were your big fights? What were the specific issues that you picked?
Well, mostly I was filing complaining of police brutality, arrests without warrants, jury discrimination, excessive sentences.
Can you tell me about some of them?
I don't particularly remember, you know. I remember this one guy that told you about this. I forget his name. He'd been in jail for 2 years without a trial. And I filed a motion for a speedy trial that was denied. So then I filed a petition to remove the case from the state to the federal system. I filed a lawsuit against the Archie Brown, the presiding judge of the 144th District Court, alleging that he had discriminated against this defendant. The federal court, Judge Woods, denied my motion after a 2-3 day hearing. And I was going to appeal to the Fifth Circuit. I knew I had the case won. Judge Woods knew I could win the case. Judge Archie Brown knew I was going to win the case. The district attorney knew I was going to win the case on appeal. So they brought the defendant from jail, tell him that they would give him credit for time served and release him. And he did. He pled guilty, got released from jail, went home, ran all the way home, and never saw him again. So then we never did get to litigate that issue. See? And this is some of the things that went on.
Was that a Maldef case?
No. That was my case.
Tell me about that LULAC chapter that was being formed that you all fought.
The LULAC started, mostly LULAC was started after World War Number Two. Again, there were, LULAC consisted of the high school graduates, the guys who were, had good employment. Pretty soon after the war, Kelly Field workers hired a lot of Mexican-Americans. And some of the Kelly Field workers, mechanics, janitors and stuff at Kelly Field, joined LULAC Council No. 2. The old clique in Council No. 2 had now acquired wealth, had now moved to the north side, bought expensive homes, their children.
You were telling us about how the original members of the LULAC Council too had become affluent. And
well, yes, they prosperity. There was prosperity in the community among the old timers, and I remember one day Alonso Perales was a lawyer, wrote two books in defense of La Raza, in defense of the Mexican-Americans. Well, Alonso Perales, who was loved by the people as a fighter for Mexican-American causes, got up at a meeting one night and he said, look, a group of us are applying for a new charter in LULAC. And to truthfully, we no longer want to be associated with the pelados. Pelados meaning the peasants, the working class. You understand? And this is because every time they proposed something in LULAC and there was a vote on it, there was a lot of argument. And the new group, the new militant group coming in, would fight them. And they weren't getting their programs across. So they asked, and they walked out. They asked for a new charter. LULAC Council No. 2 protested the granting of the charter. There was a national convention in Houston, and they appealed to the national convention. At the end of the vote, there was a tie vote, and the national president, Mr. Flores from El Paso, had to cast the deciding vote whether to grant them a charter or not. He says, I'm going to adjourn the convention. I'm going to go to my room, get on my knees, and ask for divine guidance. He went to his room. About 20 minutes later, he came back and voted no. They never got a charter. That was the end of that. Later on, they came back. They came back to LULAC.
What was the different agenda between the first group and the new military?
There was a political organization called the Good Government League form. And the Good Government League selected one or two Mexicanos to run for the city council with them. And they would pick the guys who would save, they would not create problems, you understand, that would not rock the boat. And they, for example, Joe Olivares, the owner of the Continental Hotel, for example, Padilla, who went with me to Maldives, he was very conservative, played golf with the mayor and all of that. And this is why, you know, they wanted to, the Good Government League would tell him, don't let LULAC raise hell about this problem. We'll take care of it. You know, quiet us down, you understand? And this was a clash. They constituted about 10% of the membership. They had no, they could not prevail, you understand? This was the reason. But they came back, and after a while, everything settled down.
You talked about how a number of the LULAC councils formed after World War II. Was there some connection between the war, what was going on at the end of the war, that caused them to so many multiply?
Well, there was. The I don't particularly remember the name of the organization prior to LULAC. I think it was the Sons of Columbus or something like that. But organization was critical, necessary. There were this horrible discrimination cases against Mexican Americans. There were signs on restaurants, no Mexicans allowed, you understand? Signs on bathrooms in public buildings, no Mexicans allowed. All of that, we had to fight all of those things. It wasn't given to us by the state of Texas, you understand? This all came through the federal government under the 14th Amendment. Later on, the group met in Corpus Christi with the Garza brothers, and they proposed organizing a United League of Latin Americans. And that LULAC was born in Corpus Christi, about 28, 29, or 30, something like that.
Would you know how many of these people that were part of the founders of these different councils were veterans of the war?
Of World War I?
Two.
Or World War II? Oh, many of them. After the World War II, almost, LULAC was full of World War II veterans. See, the old timers died, you understand?
Mm-hmm. Let's back up a bit. When you were in Guam, and you had the friend who I think you said he was from Los Angeles, who had the phonograph, and there was another one from Laredo?
Yeah, there was about 20 of us from throughout the island that we got to meet, you understand?
Okay. And how did you seek each other out, and why did you seek each other out?
Well, I guess comradeship. Like I told you that when we were marching in, this guy called me and asked me where I was from in Spanish. And I told him I was from San Antonio. He said, so am I. And he had a bootleg and promotional on the side. And he came to visit me, and then he introduced me to the other people, and we enjoyed getting together and speaking Spanish.
Why was it important to speak Spanish?
I have no reason. No, nothing important.
It felt good?
Well, we felt very close together, you understand? So surviving together, exchange stories and all of that.
Okay. You want to stop the tape?
Yes, and I also want to put...
Let's go. Can we just go over that again? Basically, I'm trying to get what you said off tape to Maggie about why you took the effort to seek out these other fellows who spoke Spanish in Guam.
Well, I don't know of any particular reason other than associating with fellow Mexicans, you know, and speak Spanish and the culture, the history was there. We needed to be together and talk. Most of the guys from California had less education than the people from Texas, and they spoke mostly Spanish. The guys from Texas spoke some English. I remember Jerry Trejo, whose brother, Frank Trejo, was a reporter for the San Antonio Light for many, many years. Jerry Trejo was with me. And there were other guys that I remember, and we didn't know each other. We met in Guam. And I guess we felt the need to associate with each other, you know.
Was there any tension between the Mexican and the Californian?
No, none tension, none at all. We became real good friends.
Well, it probably sounds like I'm asking the same question over and over, but since you said before that you weren't feeling any discrimination in the service, you know, by Anglos, you obviously weren't seeking relief from that, so you were looking for something else when you would get together with the other Mexicanos. What was that?
I can't pinpoint it. I can't give you an exact that I had a specific reason. There was a need for the comradeship.
One last time, let me just ask it a different way. What would you talk about with them that you wouldn't talk about with Anglo soldiers?
Again, I don't recall any particular problem. Mostly girls, you know, stuff. We're young kids. 1920-21.
Okay. Let's go back to the Good Government League and their efforts.
Okay.
Who were the members of the Mexican American community that were more likely to be aligned with the Good Government League, and what was it?
The affluent members, and they were selected very carefully. They didn't want people in the council who would create problems for them. And we in the LULACs wanted members on the council that would represent the Mexican-American community and their problems. You understand? And these guys were in there to quiet us down, to keep us quiet. You understand? They say, we will solve your problems for you. We are with the majority. We are with the establishment. This is where the problems are coming from. We know they're there, but let us do it our way, quietly. Which means no, nothing at all.
What kind of confrontations did the two groups have?
You mean Good Government League?
Well, the LULAC members that were sort of aligned with the Good Government League versus the other ones.
Well, nothing other than they were. Not accepted as cordially as before, you understand?
And I guess what do you think made them more sympathetic to the Good Government League's, you know, positions?
Who?
These members of LULAC. These affluent members.
They weren't selected?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they were looking for self-survival. You know, I guess they improved their social and economic status by being with the wealthy class, with the Good Government League.
Did they recognize?
Most of them had businesses, you understand? And they were employers, not employees. And they were looking to better themselves, and they felt that the best way was to join the establishment, the power structure.
Did they recognize that the other problems were going on for other?
Yes, absolutely. They knew.
But their answer was?
Yeah, they didn't want them to create any problems. They didn't want any protest, any marching down the street, you know.
Editor, this is Room Tone. Interim tone? Now you want to keep the time code continuous here at this point, or start with it?
Start with zero again.
Okay.